From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made more than 20 years ago in Rochester, and something that became known as the Sunday Salon began with an organization called Feminists for Nonviolent Choices. You might have heard of them. They're pro-life feminists, and they wanted to reach out to the pro-choice community. Here was the idea, a weekend gathering, small, just 6 or 8 people coming together for coffee or wine and cheese, and a chance to talk and to listen. With an issue that is as supercharged as abortion, we all can make the mistake of dehumanizing those who don't agree with us. The Sunday Salons were meant to offer a window of understanding of where different points of view come from. Over the years, those salons have waxed and waned, but they're still happening, and when I found out about them, I asked some of the women from Feminists for Nonviolent Choices if they might be willing to recreate a kind of Sunday salon right here on Connections. After all, the ethos of this program is about respectful dialogue, even on the most divisive issues. And I'm happy to say they've agreed. So this hour, we're going to talk about abortion. We'll also talk about how to better understand people who disagree with us. And it might offer a nice model for how we should view our differences as we move into 2016. After all, it has been a really polarizing year in politics and in social issues, hasn't it? My guests for the hour include Carol Crossan, who's here from Feminists for Nonviolent Choices. Carol, it's nice to see you in studio.
Thank you.
Nice to see you as opposed to seeing, we kind of pass emails back and forth over the year. So it's great to see Carol here, as well as Meg Smirbeck. And Meg is also with Feminists for Nonviolent Choices. Hi, Meg.
Hi.
It's a packed studio, by the way. We'll be trading microphones back and forth. Reverend Karen Anderson's here. She's a senior minister with the First Unitarian Church. And Reverend Anderson, nice to have you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Aria Camioni-Lind is here. And she works in social justice and is simply here talking about her views on pro-choice, pro-life, et cetera. Aria, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And Michelle Hopwood is here as well, talking about her stances in pro-choice. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to start with Carol Crossan because I really do admire the model of the Sunday Salons. It goes back to, you said, 93 and 94, something like that?
Right. Our president of Feminists for Nonviolent Choices invited members from her temple, other women, and they began having a Sunday salon. It was not on Sunday, but it began, and actually it lasted for about 18 months with the same group of women. And so once that was completed, it seemed to be such a rewarding experience for all the participants that Feminists for Nonviolent Choices decided to extend it to the broader community and continue that.
Okay, and I know that, you know, if you're going through that process, sure, you'd love to change someone's mind and they'd probably love to change yours. But what was the most value? What was the most valuable part of it for you, Carol?
Well, I think part of it, if I could very selfishly say, part of it was to make myself and the other persons who were participants better activists because we listened to each other. I think part of being an activist was to understand and respect your opponent, as Gandhi always said. So there was much of that made us better listeners. We understood each other. We respected each other.
Meg, let me ask you the same kind of questions then. Tell me about what you have gotten out of this process.
I've participated in a few Sunday salons, and I guess I'd like to say one thing that's different, obviously, about this is that we're all here, and it's on radio, so it's not confidential. But the Sunday salons that are held typically
sure
within homes that I've been at are confidential, and those, you know, rules are very well respected. So that is obviously a difference within this format. And I think I'd like to say, in addition to what Carol said, the main benefit I've received is exactly what you iterated at the beginning, is taking away any sorts of stereotypes and just realizing, you know, we're all persons here, particularly folks who are ready to come here and have this discussion, who really care about people.
Well, let's kind of go around the table and ask then about stereotypes. And I'll work backwards here. Michelle Hopwood, you're pro-choice.
Yes.
And what do you think the biggest misconception people who are not pro-choice have about you or people who are pro-choice?
That we don't place a value on life overall. That the life of the baby, and for me, that's an important distinction. I don't call an unborn child a fetus. Mm-hmm. I call it a baby from the beginning. And I think there's a feeling that, well, if you're okay with aborting a baby, then you don't value life. You don't value life until you've given birth to it. It doesn't count. It's not really
it's not important. And having lost a baby in an early miscarriage, I faced that very early, that people said, well, it was, you know, it was just a fetus. You know, you just, no, that was a baby. It was a wanted baby. It was a loved baby from the minute we found out I had a baby. And then 10 weeks later, we didn't have one anymore. So it made a big difference when people, in a different discussion, when someone said something about aborting a fetus that was the same age as the baby that I no longer had. So even though I now have a very healthy 1-year-old son, but I've had people have trouble with being able to marry those two things together, that you can respect life and love life and be okay with that, but still be all right with someone having the freedom to choose to abort that life if they want to.
Yeah, okay. Aria, what would you say the biggest misconception you feel as someone who is pro-choice?
Sure. I think I will piggyback on what Michelle said, and I think that the biggest misconception is that people who are pro-choice hate babies and hate children, and that's not the case. I'm the proud mom of 3 lovely kids, another lovely kid who is up in heaven that I didn't get to keep, but that in the end, women are humans with dignity and worth and can make their own healthcare decisions along with their healthcare providers. So I think the misconception is that we don't care about life, like Michelle said. We don't care about the little babes and the kids, but we do. And we care about women's lives.
Okay. Reverend Anderson, how would you describe what you think the biggest misconception about your position as someone who is pro-choice?
I think these guys hit the nail on the head, really, about kind of the biggest piece against pro-choice people. Also, the idea that we put people in boxes about what they are and we polarize the issue. And unfortunately, I think that abortion is always contextual, and that never gets part of the conversation. And that needs to be brought in over and over and over again. So we don't do that. So we say you're one thing and you're the other thing, and there's no in between. And in my opinion, abortion is gray matter in between those two polar opposite kind of ways of how we talk about it most of the time.
Okay. Now, let me ask our pro-life panelists. So, Meg, I'll start with you then. What do you think for you is the stereotype about the pro-life movement that people who are not pro-life have that you hear most often?
I think that personally what I sometimes will experience is the whole thing of that I don't respect women and their decision-making abilities. And that's really not at all true. I do very much respect women, and that is true within the pro-life movement. And so I think that that is probably the number one thing that I've had within civil discussions. There certainly are, you know, people who, once they get to know me, they'll know I'm not someone who goes screaming baby killer or any of the things of the very extreme things you'll see. So most folks that know me and who are reasonable know that most people who label themselves as pro-life do not go to those extremes. But so I would say on the personal level, it's just sort of, you know, that I want to strip away women's rights when, in fact, that's why being part of the feminist organization has really appealed to me.
Okay. Carol, same question then for you.
Yeah, I think that it's a misconception to think that people who are pro-life are conservative or Republican or right-wing. I think, in fact,
you're both Democrats, you said. Is that what you said, Meg?
Okay. Yep. We're both feminists. I've been arrested protesting war a number of times. I was arrested with a group protesting against homelessness. So I don't identify with right-wing conservative politics at all. So I think that would be the biggest hurdle to overcome as far as I'm concerned.
And Carol, have you then, and Meg, kind of same question, given the fact that you describe yourself as Democrats who are obviously not only pro-life, but it's a big core of your beliefs and values. It must be hard for you to really feel like you've got a, I don't want to say a party, but a vote that you feel good about very often, given that. Is that, is that
it
right?
Is difficult.
Yeah.
That certainly is difficult. But for myself, I feel like the Democratic Party identifies with so many of the things that I do believe in. It certainly is a challenge for me.
I mean, are you actually holding your nose when you vote sometimes?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
I do hold my nose.
Yeah, and Meg, same kind of thing? Yeah.
Same thing. I think, in fact, one time an article you wrote was, you know, it's my party and I'll cry if I want to, because we kind of joked in my family when I was growing up that we were like almost baptized Democrat because I grew up in a very politically active family. Certainly... the pro-choice position of the Democratic Party causes me conflict, and yet there's so much of the basic belief of, I mean, one thing I sort of like, and it's another thing that attracts me to the pro-life movement, is with the Democratic Party is kind of like sort of going for the underdog and the workers and the those things that I view. And I find that very consistent with the pro-life position.
Okay. Well, I want to go back to Michelle Hopwood, who is pro-choice, and she said something I thought right off the bat that was, I think, really, really valuable to this conversation. Because when we talk about issues, especially third rail, you know, when you host a talk show, people say, well, you can't talk about abortion, you can't talk about religion, you can't talk about sex, those kind of things that are third rail subjects. And I always say, I think we can. We have to try to do it in a way that is exactly what you're hearing so far from this panel today. Michelle said something, I think, right off the bat that gave a little ground. And I always think it's important when you think about, even if we're not going to agree on something, what do I see in someone who's an ideological opponent that I can give some ground to, that I can offer some respect? And, you know, Michelle, you said right off the top, for you, that was a life that you were carrying, that it was. So this question of when does life begin, when does it not begin, at the very least, we can agree that at conception, something is alive, right? Something is growing. That is life. I understand the difference between having a conversation on when do you define as a human life, when do you not, but at the very least, sometimes people say, well, that's not life yet. And what you seem to be saying is, of course it is. It's alive. It's growing, right?
Correct.
And do you find that at least allowing that, you know, bridges something when you talk to people who are pro-life?
I think it often does, because for me, in conversations I've had with people who are pro-choice and people who are pro-life, the fetus versus baby seems to be very, very polarizing. Mm-hmm. People who are hardline, don't want to hear anything other than that, pro-choice, don't ever want to identify with the baby as a baby. They want to call it a fetus, because I think in some way that sort of distances you emotionally from it, whereas pro-choice often, usually in my experience, says baby because there's an emotional attachment to a baby. You don't want to hurt a baby.
Pro-life says baby, yeah.
Right. Nobody wants to think about hurting a baby. Abortion hurts a baby, kills a baby. I'm okay with it. That's the sort of the way it's difficult sometimes to talk to, and people get very emotional about that because I think it's still a choice. Until it's a viable baby, I think a woman has a choice to not have that baby anymore.
I think that's really an intellectually honest position. And I have to think that Meg and Carol probably get driven a little nuts over the years of hearing people say, well, it's not life yet. Because sometimes you hear that, right, Meg?
Absolutely. So I very much appreciate your frankness with that.
Yeah. And, you know, Carol's nodding too. Now, they might be also driven a little nuts, but I hear you then say, but I still respect that choice. But then, so let me follow up and ask you then, Michelle, do you find, is it important, Is it a relevant question to you on when that life, and it's life, is a human life or a human life worthy of protection, or all these sort of parts of the debate that we kind of move into?
Yes, I think so. And the other problem is with all the medical advances, and I work at Strong, where we do amazing medical work, all the advances, quote-unquote viable human life, is getting earlier and earlier. And I'm also a volunteer for a group called Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep, and we do infant bereavement photography for babies who are never going to go home.
Yeah.
So I see a lot of that, and a lot of babies who are born full term who aren't ever going to leave the hospital. So, and born very early sometimes, you know. But I also have a friend who has a 23-week triplet survive, one surviving out of three triplets, out of three babies. So there's a lot of that and where the viability line comes, and it gets earlier and earlier as medical science moves ahead. So it's hard.
Okay, well, let me ask Carol then, as someone who's participated in these salons, and if you're just joining us, we're talking abortion this hour. A nice, light, easy subject that everyone agrees on. You know, we're talking a very important issue that divides a lot of people, and we've asked the folks from Feminists for Nonviolent Choices, a local organization, a group of pro-life feminists that have been hosting these kind of Sunday salons, as they call them, for years, to come in and to kind of show it publicly. And Meg's right. I mean, these salons have been private discussions for years, but I really admire the structure to it, the way that says we're going to talk, we're going to try not to be disrespectful or insulting, we're going to try to listen. So Carol Crossett is someone who's had these conversations for years with people. And of course, you've tried to not only listen, but to sway people and to get them to think. What's one of the first questions that comes to your mind when you hear the three women in this room who are pro-choice? You know, what would you pose to them if you're having this conversation privately, which is really easy to say, right? We're sitting on public radio. But what would you want to ask them? You know, what are the first things that kind of move into your mind to help you understand them better?
Right. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate Michelle's intellectual honesty. I think that is refreshing to acknowledge that it is a baby, to use your words, and to say that you have the choice to take the life of that baby. I don't think that's unlike people who defend capital punishment, for instance, who recognize this is a life and that we do have the right to take that life. I personally don't think we do. I'm opposed to capital punishment.
Our group opposes it, yes.
Yes, our group does. And just by way of putting a framework around the nonviolence part of who we are, Feminists for Nonviolent Choices is a consistent life ethic organization that is a member of a network of almost 200 groups across the country that say taking life in war, abortion, capital punishment, euthanasia, and poverty are wrong. So I think that's a very intellectually honest statement that you made, and it serves to open up dialogue where I would personally be very interested to hear more about what you have to say.
I think that's a productive start. I mean, Aria and Karen, do you, as an extension of that, does it matter to you, Aria, the question on how do we decide it's a human life or that human life that should be protected, et cetera? I mean, because I think polls will indicate, and I don't have the very, very latest in front of me, that Americans start to become split on abortion, especially the later into abortion you go. Americans are not in favor of third trimester. I don't think they're generally in favor of second, or it's much closer. Whereas, I think there's at least a plurality or a small majority supporting first-term abortion. So obviously Americans have a lot of things that they wrestle with when it comes to abortion throughout a pregnancy. Does that question matter to you on deciding human life?
Sure. I think to steal Karin's term, I would call it contextual, that it's always contextual. So, for instance, I also lost a baby at the very end of my first trimester, almost 10 years ago, and it was very sad, and I felt like I lost a person who was in my family that we were never going to get to know. But I think that's in the context of me. I was a young woman. I had one other child. My husband and I were very keen on building our family. And so that was my context. But if you had stuck me back in college when I was 19 and I had the rest of my degree and my graduate work and all of the good work I hope I'm doing now ahead of me, the context would have been wildly different. Or if you catch me in 5 years, the context will be different again. So I think that it's important that, you know, we give ground to each other so that we can have productive conversations, but also to remember that one person's context isn't another person's mm-hmm. context, and that women are able to decide which decisions work best for them in their own context.
Is there a trimester or a portion in the pregnancy that you would no longer support abortion as an option?
So my personal preference for that is a viability discussion between a doctor and the woman who's considering abortion. So that, like Michelle said, viability can be different in different contexts. You know, the further we move with scientific strides, the earlier viability can be. And so, but I think that's really a conversation between a woman and her medical practitioner.
Does pain capability matter to you?
I think that's part of that conversation, that it's so nuanced and there are so many details that you have to consider that, you know, you or me or Karn or any of these other lovely people who are here today, we can't make a blanket statement about that. Okay. We really have to leave that up to, number one, the scientists and the doctors who know all the details that we don't, and the women whose lives it will affect.
Okay, before I get to some of your phone calls and comments here, which it really does make it the opposite of a Sunday salon, this kind of a setting, and we keep pointing that out, but which is even more why I so admire the five women in this room, because they're really putting themselves out there on an issue that is very sensitive. Reverend Karn Anderson, to you, is there a point in the pregnancy that is any kind of a cutoff point that you would find no longer supporting abortion as an option?
I agree with Aria that it is between a doctor and the woman who's pregnant. It's in regards to a viable life. I also would say that it is life that you are aborting. I wouldn't call it a baby myself, but I have no argument of
it's
saying
life.
It's life. That's what an embryo is, and a fetus as it grows. I wouldn't ever argue against that. I agree with these guys. It's life.
Okay. So here's what I think I want to do as we move throughout the hour in this. We have some phone calls. We have some comments here. I'm going to ask anyone who comments or calls in. We're also going to try to keep the tone moving in the same kind of civil, courteous manner here. Doesn't mean we all have to agree. Of course we don't. And that's not the point. The point is the way we conduct these discussions. So let me start with Keith. First up here. Go ahead, Keith.
I have an interesting program. I'm probably older than most of the women there, but I've learned a long time ago that there are no moral absolutes. And making abortion illegal or even restricting abortion will not stop abortion. It ultimately should be a decision between the woman and her doctor. And I firmly and personally believe that it should be available. And the problem we have, to some extent, is people's religious belief get thrust into a medical decision. Now, I'm not saying abortion is right or wrong. I'm not going to determine that because, as for myself, I will never, being a guy, I cannot, you know, determine that. That's up to the woman. But I still think it should be there. And then you have the other part of it. If the woman just can't deal with another child in her life for one reason or another, and there's no support for that, then that creates a whole nother problem. But that's not what the show is about.
Well, but Keith, thank you for the phone call. And in some ways, that's a very common part of this discussion. So let me move the conversation over to Carol and Meg, because what Keith is saying is got two prongs to it. First of all, his first point is, if we made abortion illegal, it would still happen, and it would happen in a more dangerous way than it is now. And that would endanger more women, more than it is now. And his concern is, you know, making it illegal doesn't stop it. So let's start with that. Meg, I'll start with you, and we'll ask Carol as well.
I'd like to say that that's absolutely a concern, although there certainly are problems with every medical procedure, and there's a lack of safety with abortion, as with any procedure now. I think in terms of you know, you think about having like restrictions and levels of things like past a certain gestational stage and certain laws that persons have, pro-life advocates have tried to pass, are seen as trying to control women. And yet I often think about things like if we had really, which I personally believe we should have, is good gun control laws. I mean, I think we need parameters and background checks, and I see no need for AK-47s and things like that. I would love to have all those things just gone. So if we have really great gun control laws, does that mean there's still not going to be illegal guns and violence from it? No, there still will be. Does it mean that I don't think that there should be those laws in place? I think that there should. Because without them, we're seeing what happens now is more deaths of human beings.
Okay. And so before I move over to Carol, on the second part of that, do you generally agree with what Meg just said on that aspect of it, Carol? Is that a pretty fair summation?
Yeah, I do. I think that the arguments that the NRA make for keeping it a constitutional right to own your gun and to be able to choose what kind of gun you want to own, a lot of those arguments are identical wording to pro-choice arguments on abortion.
Okay. And before we move it around the rest of the panel, which I think this is good, this is healthy, on the second part of Keith's point, we've had a couple of emails that kind of mirror that. Here's an example. Travis writes to us and says, thanks for having discussions like this. Civil conversations about touchy subjects need to happen more. I just wanted to point out something that common pro-lifers seem to neglect when making their arguments. They say they value life, and that's why they are against abortion, and yet they don't bat an eye when discussing war or poverty or the death penalty. That comes across to me as a strong contradiction. I'm not referencing the people on your panel today, but that's something I've experienced in having private discussions with friends. So first of all, we've already cleared up. We have a diversity of pro-life views in the world and certainly reflected on this program, because what Travis just described is not reflected by Carol and Meg. But what Keith described as well, here's the other stereotype I often hear. You care about the child before it's born, you don't care about the child after it's born, and you have to consider women in poverty, for example. You know, having an unwanted child, often a single parent, is going to impact that woman in a very, very difficult way. It's probably going to impact that child and make that child's life very, very challenging, probably living in poverty, sometimes extreme poverty, and taking away her option, reproductive option, is going to make life very, very tough for that child to come and for that woman. And Keith was sort of making the same kind of point. And I know you hear that a lot. So I'll start with you, Carol. What do you say?
Yeah, I think that it really, if you think about it honestly, I think it is in the government's advantage to promote and encourage abortion, because it eliminates the need for education of children, the need to find housing for families. It reduces food stamps, the need for food stamps. Economically, abortion makes sense, doesn't it? But we believe that we can't eliminate poverty by eliminating poor people and their children, basically.
Okay, so it kind of sounds like what you're saying is it's a cop-out, and that we need better economic policies, more egalitarianism in general here. Mm-hmm. And that abortion shouldn't be viewed as a route away from that.
And that absolutely with our group is in terms of finding real solutions. And I can even say that particularly within Democrats for Life, that we think that the policies supported within there really align much better and with that of supporting life. And then I think I would also say that, when persons get into viability and then life after the womb and supporting it, sometimes will look at that then as age discrimination, because if a child then, you know, they get to like 6 month gestation and then they can make it and then they're born, then if they're in poverty, we don't shoot them. Pardon me. We don't shoot them then. So it's sort of this whole thing of it's okay within the womb, but then we'll just go and deal with it then. Well, we're not going to do that. So therefore, we believe it's important to just support that and to give them good life prior to being born and after.
Okay. I know Aria and some of our pro-choice panelists wanted to weigh in on some of what you've been hearing. Go ahead, Aria.
Sure. I just have some information to share with your listeners and the other panelists. These are statistics from the Guttmacher Institute. Half of all pregnancies among American women are unintended. Of those, 4 in 10 end in abortion. Nearly 3 in 10 American women will have an abortion by age 45. And that abortions among women of color are 5 times the rate of their white counterparts. So that when we look at this, when we look at this access to abortion question, when we look at what time, so for instance, 64.5% of all abortions happen at 8 weeks or fewer gestational age. So we're talking about, like, you find out you're pregnant and 5 minutes later you go get an abortion. So we're not talking about most of what happens isn't a woman sitting in her living room worrying, should I or shouldn't I? It's a woman saying, now is not the right time for me. I got to go get this taken care of. And so when you look at these statistics that are available, when you look at the communities that we live in, you can see that it's not just one thing or the other, like we've been saying. It's that economic status, the historical and cultural context of race relations in the United States play into this decision that women make, and including things like access to health care. Women of color are less likely to have access to health care. They're less likely to have access to things like an IUD, which is very effective and helps prevent abortion in a big way. Between 2008 and 2014, abortions decreased among higher income women. Lower income women, they didn't decrease. So when you talk about this, you talk about all the access and the privilege issues that surround women in our communities.
Some of the feedback is indicating that what Aria is touching on here is a big point of cognitive dissonance among people who are kind of listening or at least observing what is typically the debate on abortion. And here's what I mean by that. One of these stereotypes, true or not, fair or not, is that people who are pro-life tend to be against sex ed, you know, comprehensive sex ed, access to contraception, et cetera. And a lot of people, Aria, do you find there to be cognitive dissonance to wanting to decrease abortions, but also being against access to contraception, comprehensive sex ed, et cetera?
I do. I also, I can't find it in my notes exactly, but there, African-American and Hispanic adolescents have far less access to reliable and consistent reproductive health education than their white counterparts. And so when we look at statistics like women of color are 5 times more likely to have an abortion than their white counterparts, it's a small part of a really big picture that we're not addressing. We're not addressing our youth in a meaningful way. And when we don't address our youth in a meaningful way, and we end up with women who have much higher than the national average rates of abortion, it sort of leaves you feeling like, well, like, women are having abortions. This is going to happen no matter what. And to Keith's point, what happens if we take that away? Then we'll have more women dying of abortions. That's what happens. And so I also wanted to point out, if anyone is interested in morbidity statistics about abortion, you can find that at the CDC surveillance report. There's a morbidity section that gives you good data from 49 states and territories in the United States.
Okay. And just real briefly, Carol and Meg from the Feminists for Nonviolent Choices, do you find any cognitive dissonance between people who are pro-life but also would say support, for example, abstinence-only education as opposed to comprehensive sex ed or access to birth control, et cetera? Is there any dissonance, or what do you think about that?
Well, I think that perhaps the cognitive dissonance in pro-life people, and I have to include myself here, is that we are confused and not real clear, and we need a real serious dialogue about the kinds of birth control and contraception that actually expel a fertilized egg, which would be, we would call, an abortifacient. I think there's like, what, 20 different kinds of contraceptives, and 4 of those, my understanding, is an abortifacient. So those we would not support. So I think that that is a really, really good conversation to have for people who are, in fact, concerned about making access to birth control more affordable, more accessible, so that the abortion rate would go down.
Okay. Here's an email from a listener named Jay in Pittsburgh who says, is there room in this discussion for those of us who do not believe that a fetus is the same thing as a baby? I think that there are many people who believe that a fertilized egg, a blastocyst, or even an embryo or fetus is not a baby, similar to how a caterpillar is not a butterfly. It's just the way I see it. Jay, of course there's room in the discussion for that, and I don't mean to imply there's not. I think what we were trying to establish, especially with Michelle early on, is sometimes a way to establish some common ground is essentially just to at least acknowledge that it is life of some kind. When there's conception, there is life. And sometimes I think people, I've talked to a lot of friends who are pro-life, and they feel like it gets so sterilized as if it's not technically life and until it's a human being that's been born. So, but Jay, I appreciate that point. And let me follow up on one of his questions then, for Carol and Meg especially. He's kind of wondering, why are you, you say that second that conception happens, why are you protecting it like it's a life when, for a long time at least, and I say a long time, for weeks, it is a collection of cells that doesn't feel pain, you know, and that is very small. And, you know, why are you protecting it in the same way right after conception, you know, as opposed to at least getting the option to stop the growth of that, knowing what the possible outcome and consequences will be? Why is that the same to you? So, Carol?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we do want to look at science. I think that is a huge thing. You know, we say that we need to look at the science of climate change. And so let's look at the science. And the science says, I think it's Embryology 101, that says that the fertilized egg has two sets of chromosomes. They make 23 chromosomes. They're in a particular configuration. A human being is going to be carrying a human being. She's not carrying a feline fetus. So science says that this has the same chromosomal structure as a human being. So, I mean, it's a human being. You can call it a fetus, you can call it a baby, you could call it a blastocyst, but when it's fertilized, it's a human being.
Okay. And Meg?
And I believe that it really just sort of gets down to then a responsibility to care for that human being. And there are times, for instance, there's a law that your child needs to be in a car seat. I don't think you can just say, well, you know, I carried this child, so I'll make my own decision. Well, no, you can't make your own decision because it is a separate human being, but you are physically responsible for that child, whether you are a mother or a father or a caregiver. If for whatever reason that child is within your presence, you do need to make decisions to protect it. So I would think that, again, I guess I'm going to come back to the age discrimination, because therefore, if it is a separate life, but given the biology, it right at that point, there is responsibility to protect the life.
Okay, Reverend Anderson, did you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah. I think one of the pieces that feels like cognitive dissonance for me right now is taking a fetus out of a woman's body, as in it could survive on its own without a woman, you know, helping to make that fetus grow and become a baby that's viable. So that feels like an odd conversation to have about a human being that still is dependent on the mother. And the piece, I guess, that I feel like always gets lost in these conversations is compassion, both for the mother who is in a difficult situation and trying to make a decision that's best for her family and for herself, and also for families, that these decisions affect other children in a family. They affect larger systems, both like larger extended families, but that we don't talk about compassion towards women, that they have, not like we talk about choice as if you're going to the grocery store and you're picking between five different kinds of cereal. In my experience, counseling women for 20 years, they'll come to me as a pastor with various degrees of thinking through what it means to be able to decide whether or not to keep a pregnancy going or to end it. It's a very complicated, very emotional, much larger conversation. And the compassion for a woman in that situation gets extracted from all of this, and the compassion goes to the fetus instead. And I find that really sad. And I guess that's where this gets complicated for me when you talk about it outside of a woman's body.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense to you, Meg? Go ahead.
Yeah. Karen, I think you bring up a really good point in terms of, you know, you want to talk about how it's going to affect the family and systems and all those things, that it's a big decision. And I also, though, Evan, I might even just put you on the spot in terms of, do you think that the father should have a say?
Should have a say.
In the decision. As a feminist, and I know as pro-life feminists, well, you know, you don't care about women or whatever, and that we keep hearing about that it's a woman's choice. But I think Karen brings up a really great point in terms of whether or not to have another child does affect more siblings. It mm-hmm. affects the existing families. Maybe they're already have brought a child home and living with their parents and have grandparents that are very strapped and tired. Certainly, and we wholly support having a father pay child support and supporting that child throughout its life. And that absolutely needs to happen when there's a baby, and if their parents aren't married or whatever, both parents need to be supporting and caring for the child. So I guess I'm just sort of curious in regard to the having a father have a say.
Who say? Yeah, don't you love you? You invite a great guest like Meg. I thought we were getting along so well, and she has to turn it around to the host. I think it's a really important question. I also think the first step is to realize that it is the woman who's carrying the child. Mm-hmm. You know, man's not carrying the child, and I want to see more active, involved dads everywhere.
Right.
Whether it is families in poverty.
I think we all do.
Yeah. Urban, suburban, et cetera. So I really pride myself in that. I will only say, since you turned to ask on me, I think that there has to be the couple deciding, you know, how they make their choices together. But ultimately, you know, I'm not sure. I think men need to realize just the inequity in terms of the burden sometimes. And so a couple should have a productive discussion on how they want to make decisions, and that'll be ultimately up to them. I wouldn't tell couples how they decide. Mm-hmm. But there certainly, you know, isn't an evenness when it comes to who is carrying a child and bearing a child and the impact on a person's life and body, et cetera. So it's a fair question. Look, I am way late for a break. This is a great time to get a break. We're supposed to break 20 minutes ago. Look what you guys have done. So if you've been waiting on the phone, we're going to come right back to phone calls for the rest of the hour. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about abortion with a panel of women, two pro-life, three pro-choice. Please don't accuse me of stacking the deck. We tried our best to really even this out, and we've got a great panel. And they've really been having, a good, productive discussion. Carol Crossett and Meg Smerbeck are here from Feminists for Nonviolent Choices. Reverend Karen Anderson's here, senior minister from the First Unitarian Church. Aria Camioni-Lind is here. She works in social justice. She's pro-choice. Michelle Hopwood is here. She's pro-choice. Your phone calls are next for the rest of the hour on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, what's new in food in the Rochester Finger Lakes region in 2015? There were a number of new places that opened this year, from coffee to bake shops to restaurants of all kinds. And we're going to run down that list. We're going to hear from some of the owners. We'll talk about their hopes for their first full year in 2016. And if we miss anything, let us know. New in food next hour. Welcome back to Connections. Jill in Pittsford is next. Go ahead, Jill.
Hi. You know, my question is really trying to amplify a focus on the experience of women's lives as they make reproductive choices and their whole reproductive lives. And I think the question that I'd like to pose to the panel is, what do women need in order to be good mothers? I think it's a question that really gets to the heart of the idea of the importance of context. I'm a volunteer at Connect and Breathe, which is a non-judgmental post-abortion talk line. And when I listen to women from all over the country talk through their and process their experience of choosing to terminate their pregnancy, it becomes so clear that there's no way to bracket a conversation about abortion as if it's an isolated incident or if it can be contained to issues of viability. So frequently when you hear women tell the story about their reproductive lives, they start talking about having a spouse who is violent. They talk about poverty. They talk about lack of support in terms of employment. They talk about having other children with disabilities. And so the interconnected weave of the whole picture, I think it's left out. And so I really wanted to hear people talk about the idea of motherhood and what, in an ideal world, women need in order to be good mothers, because I think that's really where Karen was talking about the abortion as a gray matter between how we talk about other issues. I really think that's it. I think it gets us to a bigger ethical place. I know that feminists for reproductive, for nonviolent choices are talking about ethics, but I think ethics live most passionately and intimately in that space of mothering.
Thank you for the phone call, Jill. I'll let Feminists for Nonviolent Choices. Carol, Meg, you want to start there? Go ahead, Carol.
Yeah, I mean, I affirm everything you've said. I think that we do have to look at motherhood and the needs that women have. Our group is active with raising the minimum wage. We've done a number of things and opposed to domestic violence. We've had forums on that, and I think that all of that is part of the bigger picture that we have to be absolutely. It's a holistic answer.
Michelle,
I think that sometimes, as the caller asked about women's part as being mothers, I think in the process of the abortion discussion, the pregnancy, childbirth, the other side of it is that women get lost. While I was pregnant, people often talked about all that's important is a healthy baby. Well, I wasn't an incubator. I existed. And while I was in the process of labor, I went into multiple organ failure and wasn't sure I was ever leaving the hospital. So there's a whole other side to it, that this whole piece endangers the life of the mother as well. And we're long past the time in history where maternal death rates were very, very high at the beginning of this century and previous. We're very low maternal death now, but it's still a very big risk. It's very dangerous to give birth, even in modern times, even with a hospital like Strong right here. It's still very dangerous, and people get lost in that. While you're pregnant, now you should carry this baby and give birth, even if you decide adoption, which nobody's really touched on here. There is a place for babies whose parents aren't ready to have them. Adoption is absolutely out there, and there's thousands and thousands of parents who want your children, who want to raise a baby that they didn't give birth to. It's a hard thing to give up. I can't imagine giving up my child, but you can give birth and have a loving, supportive family who's economically everything. And it doesn't really matter the color of the child's skin. There are people who want to raise other people's babies. But at the same time, that mother is still more than just an incubator, and bringing that baby into the world, it can end that mother's life. And it happens. So I think that also gets put to the side a little in this discussion.
All right, in the blink of an eye, we're essentially out of time. And we've had a number of listeners saying, how can we get involved in future Sunday salons? Or should and people saying we should hold our own. I agree. I think we should all be doing that. But Carol Crossed, first of all, Feminists for Nonviolent Choices, are you online?
We are, and you can look us up Do you know what
So it's ffnvc.org.
FFNVC.
Yep, Feminists for Nonviolent Choices.org.
Okay, so, and yes. I guess if they contact you, maybe they can participate in future conversations?
Absolutely, they
okay.
can.
Okay, and but, you know, we all can hold our own kind of Sunday salons. So let me just try to figure out how do I give the last 15 seconds aside here. Reverend Anderson, go ahead. What do you want to leave the audience with in 15 seconds on this issue? You have to sum up abortion in 15 seconds.
Set up abortion in 15 seconds. I think in a perfect world, there would be no abortion. The problem is we don't live in a perfect world. If we want less abortions, we need greater access to contraception and better comprehensive sex ed.
All right, Meg, your final thoughts. Go ahead.
I just truly welcome anyone who's interested in a Sunday salon to come and go online. I've really enjoyed this discourse and appreciate you having us.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. And Carol Crossed was the one who really sparked this interest of mine, because I just admire the concept, and I wish we had 2 hours for it. A great panel, so thanks to all of you for being here. Listeners, if we didn't get through, we're going to talk, maybe we'll talk about these kind of issues in 2016 a little more often, as long as we keep the heat down. We have to have hard conversations if we keep the heat down. Short break, more Connections. Thanks.